Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
I'll confess, sometimes I let my podcast playlist get out of hand and I get way behind, but there's one show that I subscribe to and any new episode goes right to the top of the queue. That's the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's because I never have to figure out, okay, is this one going to be interesting or do I wait for the next one like I do for some shows? Because Jordan's conversations are always a must-listen for me. He talks to fascinating people from any category you can think of. Authors, scientists, athletes, you name it. He's talked to undercover cops who posed as mafia and the actual career mafia hitmen. And the stories he gets out of these people, just incredible. In one episode, he talked to Paul Holes. You might know that name if you're into true crime. He's the former investigator who uses really advanced methods to solve cold cases, including the Golden State Killer. And another one I really enjoyed was with Sam Harris, an author and neuroscientist who promotes skepticism, and he doesn't mind taking on some seriously controversial topics like politics or religion. That one's going to make you think. Whenever a new episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show pops up, I already know it's going to be an episode that I'll enjoy listening to, and I'll bet you will too. For some episode recommendations, check out jordanharbinger.com/start. Or search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
What Was That Like? Contains adult language and content and is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to What Was That Like? I'm your host, Scott Johnson. This is a show where we talk to regular people, people just like you or just like me, who have found themselves in an extremely unusual situation. We'll hear their stories and get inside their head because we all want to know, what was that like? More information about each episode at whatwasthatlike.com. Here we go. Have you ever thought about what it would be like to lose one of your legs? I think just about everyone just takes their legs for granted. We've always had them. They get us where we need to go. And they just do their job until they don't. My guest on the show today is Josh. He was in the Army and stationed in Iraq, and he worked as a gunner inside an Abrams tank. One day his tank parked over a roadside bomb, and there was an explosion that destroyed the tank, along with Josh's left foot. Josh told me the whole story from the moment it happened to somehow exiting the tank and getting to safety, his multiple surgeries, and his decision to finally just amputate and be done with it. He talked about prosthetics and what it was like to put that on for the first time and what he's able to do with his new leg. And Josh also has some advice for other vets and amputees about how he's dealt with the situation. He's come a long way, including struggles with alcohol and depression, but he's also quick to point out, life's looking good now. I was happy to hear that, and I'm proud of Josh and what he's done since that day in Iraq. He's a good example of why we owe such a debt of gratitude to the men and women that serve in the military all around the world. For everything Josh and I discussed, I'll have links in the show notes for this episode at the website, which is at whatwasthatlike.com/06. I'll also have Josh's email address there if you'd like to contact him directly. And if you want to see pictures of Josh as well as the destroyed tank, you can follow me on Instagram at whatwasthatlike, no spaces. So without further ado, my conversation with Josh. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk about an explosion today, and I want to know when the explosion first happened, right then, did you actually realize the extent of your injuries?
No. I wasn't even sure of anything at that present moment. The first thing that I tried to do was find my cigarette that I had just lit. And then once everything started fading in, I could start hearing again. Everybody was screaming, and that's when I realized, holy crap, I'd been blown up. And then I actually started to check myself, but I didn't really feel much yet. I knew something was wrong, but my foot would have been crushed, and I felt like a lot of pressure because I wasn't in pain yet.
Was no pain at that point?
No, just a lot of pressure.
Wow. What when you say pressure, what can you describe that? What does that mean?
Like somebody had sat on your leg or something. Felt more like that than actual pain.
Okay. All right. Well, let's back up for a minute. And you were in the Army. How old were you when you actually joined the military?
I joined the day I turned 17. My parents signed a slip saying that I could join, you know, during that time, or that early rather. So
you can sign up at 17 if you have parents' permission, or 18 on your own. Is that the way?
Correct.
Okay. And then what was your age when you actually went to Iraq?
19.
So you were 19 years old. What kind of training do you get before you actually go into the theater of war?
Well, that's different from, it's a combination of different kinds of training. You know, you have your one station unit training, which is what most combat arms jobs do. Which is your job training and basic training together. And it's just one shot. And for me, it was a little over 4 months in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And they moved the armor school down to Benning now. But then there's that. And then once you have your job training, depending upon what your station is at the tank, you're doing, you know, scenarios and stuff like that at your duty station. And then you have more specific things like a convoy simulator, which is a video game, basically, and you're learning how to function as a unit like that, or you have additional training. Like we learn more about IEDs than or a normal person would because we were going there.
And IED for people that don't know what that is?
Improvised explosive device.
So typically a bomb that's somewhere on the side of the road usually, is that right?
It could be a whole slew of different things. Those most commonly, yeah. They also have, you know, trip wires on doors, or we were told at one time that they would hide some behind posters, and it's like when you tear them down, it releases it. It's a pretty general term, but the most common, yeah, are the ones on the side of the roads or underneath the road. There's also pressure plates, which are like a mine, and that they've trigger the explosive. And then there's also EFP, which is explosively formed projectile, where they use an explosive with a copper disc to create a plasma, and then that'll just shoot straight through your vehicle. There's nothing you can do about that. So
and what was your job? What were you assigned?
I was a tank gunner on an M1 Abrams.
An M1 Abrams. Now, I've never been in the military, but what I've seen and read about the Abrams tank is that it's one of the bigger or more heavily fortified tanks. Is that right?
It's technically speaking, it's the only main battle tank in the military. otherwise it's a cavalry fighting vehicle or an armored personnel carrier. It's a technicality thing. But yes, it's 70 tons, 120 millimeter main gun. There's three machine guns on it, one for the loader on top of the turret. There's one for the tank commander on top of the turret. And then there's the coaxially mounted one. And some variants with the Tusk package, the terrain urban survivability kit, have another one mounted on the main gun. So it actually gives the gunner access to two machine guns, even though you sit down inside the tank.
And so as the gunner, you were in charge of all of those guns?
No, as the gunner, I control the main gun and the turret and the coaxial one.
And someone else, how many people are in the tank?
Four.
Four people. Okay.
But we had lost a few people, whether it be to, death or injury or family issues, but we were only running a three person that day.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about that day. You were in Iraq and I believe in the city of Mosul. Is that right?
Yep.
Just going down the road. And can you just take us on that trip and tell us what happened?
Oh, that day, oof, the beginning part to it wasn't, exciting. We swept through one side of the city, clearing IEDs on that route. And then we went across the bridge and went over to the west side.
Well, let me just stop you for a second. When you say you go through and you're clearing IEDs, how do you clear them? Do you just drive over them, let them blow up? Or
no, we drive real slow. We're a real big target and we look for IEDs. We go with EOD, explosive ordnance disposal. And they have a vehicle that has a camera and a probing arm and all that stuff on it. And then it also they have a robot that they can throw out the back and then take C4 over to it and blow it up in place. And we just go real slow and look for everything everywhere. And if we don't spot it, it'll end up blowing up on us anyway. So
right. But in most cases, when it does end up blowing up, you're so heavily armored that it doesn't do any damage or serious damage. Is that right?
Most ones that are small, especially on the tank, we don't have to worry about, for instance, tires popping because it's tracked. But we missed one. It was very clearly disguised with a whole bunch of power components, power lines and stuff like that on the side of the road. Missed it. And it detonated on, I forget the name of the vehicle. I think it's RGV, which I don't know what that stands for. It's been some time. It was a new vehicle I'd never seen before. And here we are using it. But it detonated, blew all the tires and stuff like that. And the vehicle was fine, other than the tires and the broken glass. But the glass is so thick, it breaks and it stays in place. It's ballistic glass, up to about 4 inches thick. So your
job was to go out and find these things and take care of them before someone else just happened to go down the road and hit it.
Correct.
Okay. All right. So you're out doing that and go ahead.
Well, that day we went over to the worst side of the city, which was at that time the west side, and we were retaking a black route, means it's just impassable due to IEDs and. So unless you're rolling heavy, you don't go down that way. So we were retaking Barracuda, Rat, and Weasel, which were the street names. And we were going to put up a combat outpost, Cop Inman, after my commander that had been killed in December the month before. So, but once we got over there onto that side, it started off as we got into a firefight and it was a knockdown drag out one. They stayed and actually fought quite hard. I'm not exactly sure why, as we were in armored vehicles, but they did shoot quite a few RPGs as well. Yeah, it was, so the best way to explain this, it's a large route. It's a 4-lane road, with a divider in the middle, and we're just taking contact from left and right. And we had a Bradley with us that was part of the combat engineers, and they melted down their 240 barrel, and then they finally got out of the way for us to start doing our work, you know, in the Abrams, which was screw stuff up. We'll put it that way. My sister tank, they dropped a canister round, which was interesting. I'd never seen one of those fired in combat.
What is that? What does that mean?
A canister round is it was the XM, but now it's just the M1028, I think is the nomenclature for it. But it's a hardened steel bucket full of 1,097 hardened tungsten balls that is essentially a giant shotgun out of a cannon. So it was.
So it covers a wide target area.
Correct. I think it's out to 500 meters, because then the spread out that far is just ineffectual. And they had an RPG guy, and they hit him with it, and it was just pink mist. There was nothing to... I remember the convoy commander calling across, like, "Did you kill him?" And they're like, "We don't know." And then they're like, we can't confirm it. There's no body to confirm, you know, so it was just vaporized, essentially, that person. So it was pretty nuts. I mean, we were shooting hundreds of rounds of coax. And then we had RPG skipping off the tank. That was interesting. I had known they'd skip because I had one bounce underneath my tank before, but I didn't know it would hit the tank and bounce off. That was interesting. And then seeing it land, because I was looking down my, you know, the sights, I saw it land in front of my sights, and I was like, holy crap, you know? And then it just, boom! I was like, wow!
So you saw it go off in your sights, but didn't really, there wasn't any damage to the tank from that?
Mm.
Okay.
Depending upon the RPG, there's a couple of different variants of... Originally, you know, it's just essentially a rocket-propelled grenade. It's designed to throw shrapnel, you know. But they have other ones like the RPG-7, which has, I think, a penetrator in it. But anyway, it's more anti-armor. So they have different variants of it for different purposes. So, yeah, that one, you know, went off and nothing happened. I mean, to be honest, you know, we'd been hit two other times in the tank, like directly on us, and then I'd been blown up once in a Humvee before then too. I mean, I was knocked out in that one too. But when it comes to the tank, it's hilarious looking back on it to me now, because the first one that we hit, I was like, it sounded like the main gun going off, you know, doom. And then I was like, wait, what? And they're like, oh, that's it. That's it. That's an IED. Oh, I'm fine. You know?
So you felt a little bit, invincible, sort of?
Yeah. But I was like, I didn't know how big it was or what it was, you know, that had went off. But I was just like, oh, man, this is going to be a cakewalk, dude, you know? Just not worried because, you know, IEDs were the number one killer. And I was like, oh, that's it? I'm like, ah! And, no. No. But, I mean, there is another, the one time that I got blown up in the Humvee and then I got knocked out. That one made my butthole pucker, and I was pretty nervous for a couple of days after that. The Humvee got shredded a little bit. It looked like it had been a 155 shell with some ball bearings around it. So it, you know, broke some crap, put some holes in through the hood and everything like that. But then the blast had slammed my face off the 50 cal, and this was at night, so I was wearing my NODs, night vision device, whatever. But I think everybody knows that one. But my face slapped off the 50 cal. It slapped, or it broke my NODs off of my Rhino mount, which is that little funny thing on the front of helmets you see sometimes for holding them. So I came back too after that one. And I was just, what's going on here? But I was so dazed. I was talking just about stupid stuff. And I was excited that they had just gotten Jurassic Park at the 7-Eleven. But anyway, back to the to that day. So we had finally, when we were in that firefight at the beginning, we had to pull around a corner and then go around another corner, a left, then a right, at about 200-300 meters apart. But we had split off, you know, one person down the far lane, one person right, one person left, so we could do security and have 360-degree. So we were out of our normal order of march, and that's one of the reasons why what happened. And so as we round to go down and make that second turn to go back, the streets kind of ran parallel, but it originated at that that little dogleg we took down to it. So kind of like an H without the bottom leg on it. So we had rounded the corner and then it started up again. We started taking PSAF, which is precision small arms fire, the snipers. And then we were getting more RPGs, and it was just a lot of fire. I just remember that much. It's like, man, I can't.
Heavy action, huh?
Yeah, I was just like, man, I didn't even think they had these amount of rounds. Usually they never stick around. They'll drop like a magazine or they'll drop an RPG and then, you know, hightail it out of there because they can't stand toe-to-toe with us. But this, they were going for the gold that day, and I think it's because of that IED that they had there.
So do you think they were trying to kind of fight you and direct you toward that?
Possibly. Yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense. I haven't thought about it too much. I mean, that whole area was just a shit show. But there was only about a block in between the two roads that we were originally on. So for us to be drawn over there, it was interesting. But it's a complex ambush once the IED goes off. So, yeah, once the fighting stopped, they had like a little lull for a little bit, and then we tried to get back into our order of march. We're supposed to be next to the lead vehicle, number two in the order of march, so we can, you know, defend the rest of the convoy.
And how many vehicles overall were in this march?
Oh, I gotta think here. I think maybe six.
Okay. And you were number two, or supposed to be number two.
Yeah. It's better for a smaller vehicle to be up front, so they can respond better, and then plus one of their trained people are up there looking for IEDs. So, but we just do, because technically it's convoy security is what we did in the tanks. And the only reason we were using tanks was because they had catastrophic kills, which means blows up the vehicle and everybody dies in the Bradleys. So they decided to roll the Abrams instead.
Okay.
So we are about to pull over onto the median, kind of, you know, the grass strip, well, dirt in this scenario. But and that's the number one you don't do thing, because it's too easy to just hide an IED in that. You only need to shovel, you know, and right. It's done. And it was like, okay, so everybody on my tank is like, oh, dude, no, fuck that. Like,
here's my hot take for today. If you see something advertised as a free trial, it might cost you more than you expect. At least that's my experience. I give up my credit card to try something for free for a week, then I forget about it, and now I'm paying for it every month without even noticing it. But when I signed up for Rocket Money, that ridiculous waste came to a screeching halt. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending, and it helps you lower your bills so you can grow your savings. It lets you see all of your subscriptions listed right there in one place. When you see a subscription you're paying for but you don't want, do you really want to spend an hour on the phone trying to track down some customer service agent to cancel it? Rocket Money can help you get rid of it with just a few taps. They also give me this great dashboard so I can see what I've spent this month compared to last month. And they'll even try to negotiate lower bills for me by up to 20%. So I'm spending less and saving more. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/whatwas. That's rocketmoney.com/whatwas. rocketmoney.com/whatwas.
I made a decision a long time ago. When I'm out riding my bike each morning and I cross paths with someone, I always smile at that person. And most people smile back. But I do it because even though it's a little thing, it makes a big difference for me, and maybe for them. It's just a fact. Small actions can bring big benefits. In the same way, it's also true that taking care of your gut can support the health of the rest of your body. Seed's DSO1 Daily Symbiotic benefits not just your gut, but your skin and heart health too. Seed DSO1 is part of my morning routine. If you can call it a routine, it's just two little capsules. And I feel amazing. It helps maintain the health of my heart, and it promotes regularity, which I can attest to. Sorry, that may be a little TMI there. For me, it's great that it's vegan, but it's also sugar-free, soy-free, peanut-free, gluten-free, and has no preservatives. It doesn't even need refrigeration. DSO1 has so many benefits, including the fact that it's backed by a lot of science, but I've barely scratched the surface here. What I can say, though, is that my body feels great. And I've got a promo code so you can see the benefits for yourself.
Trust your gut with Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic. Go to seed.com/what and use code 25what to get 25% off your first month. That's 25% off your first month of Seed's DS01 Daily Symbiotic at seed.com/what. Code 25what.
Hey, this is Scott. Did you know we offer a premium feed of this show that is completely ad-free and there are bonus episodes? Go to whatwasthatlike.com/plus or just click the link in the show notes of any episode to learn more and to sign up. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you can sign up right there in the app by clicking try free at the top of the episode list. And I hope to see you in the premium feed soon.
We were pissed. We're like, no, you tell them to go across the beach. This is bullshit. So I'm talking with my driver and BSing, kind of like, dude, yeah, no, this is effed up. Like, tell them to do it. You know, they have the IED resistant vehicle anyway. So it's like, you know, we'll just get back into our order march further down the road. So we pull up to the median and they're like, all right. You know, all of us are clenching, and then, you know, I light a cigarette, and Hughes yanks down on the gas, but it's kind of like a motorcycle, and that it's just a twistable throttle. So it slams down on it, and then we go over, and then boom. And, yeah. And that was the big one. It apparently was closer to actually underneath the road, and they've already had other vehicles pass it, but they were aiming for the tank as sort of a – it's better for publicity if they knock out the biggest, hardest vehicle,
right,
for propaganda and whatnot. So,
it's a pressure-activated switch, and the lighter vehicles wouldn't set it off.
No, they just didn't blow it up on them. It was a command detonated.
Oh, so somebody was watching.
Yep.
Okay.
From most likely inside the house that they had dug the tunnel from. I mean, I didn't know it at the time. You know, all I could tell was I just got blown up. But they had dug a tunnel from inside the house underneath the road. So there was no way for us to tell that there was even anything there.
Right. So were you rendered unconscious when it went off?
Yeah. Yeah. That was it was just blackout. It felt different though than the other time I had been blown up though, which always makes me wonder. Cause I'd, you know, been knocked out on that previous one, and this one felt, you know, I had like the life flash before my eyes kind of thing. Felt like I lived my whole existence again in like a split second. And everything hurt. Like my outsides were on my insides and my insides were on my outsides. And then like came to like snap to kind of like, what in the world? And I was like, where's my cigarette? You know, I was so dead certain. Like, where is it? I can't believe this just happened, you know? And I couldn't really tell. And like slowly, like all my senses came back to me. And that's when I like hearing and then I could smell. And like I'm actually looking around and like, holy shit. I was like, oh, wow. And then, yeah, like that was, we hit a big one, a real big one.
What did you see and hear?
Well, initially, because I was staring at my hand for that damn cigarette. And so I think the first thing that really came to was my hearing, because then I could hear everybody screaming. Like Hughes was screaming. My tank commander right behind me was screaming. I was just like, what in the hell? You know, and then they're screaming, not as in, you know, like out of anger, you know, it's like pain felt screaming and just a lack of who even knows. And then I could smell, and the smell was pretty nauseating because the blast had blown apart our THPDV, which is the turret hull power distribution valve, which is where the gallons of hydraulic fluid goes through to the different parts of the turret and the hull. So that had basically just, so it shot hot hydraulic fluid all over the tank. And we're, luckily it's flame resistant, but so that, and then the dirt and dust and everything, and then everything else, like the metal, like hot metal from the blast. And it was just, it was a very unpleasant smell, but, you know, they're screaming. I'm like, holy shit, you know, and then that's when I feel the pressure in my leg, you know, and I'm sitting down in the gunner's hole and I'm like, oh, something's not right. So I wanted to, you know, pull back and stuff like that. I had some cuts and scrapes and, you know, my back felt wonky and all that, but, my leg was just number one priority. So I kind of helped push my tank commander over to sit on top of the 50 cal ammo stowage in the turret. And I pulled myself out and I tried to use my foot and woo, no, that's that was one instance of pain that I'll never forget, that first time trying to use it. And then, oof, it was bad.
But at this point, your foot was still attached. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It had just been, what was the damage to your foot? It had been crushed by metal?
It was they call it a floor slap, which is when the blast caves in the bottom of your vehicle and then there's no room in there for anything, barely you, to be honest. But yeah, that's crunched down on my foot. So, you know, my foot was essentially, at the clinic later, they called it applesauce, is what they referred to my foot as. So,
not something you want your foot to be referred to as.
No.
And this was your left foot or your right foot?
My left foot.
Okay. So, you know what I'm wondering though? I'm picturing, I've never been inside a tank, obviously, but it's got to be so cramped and so tight quarters down in there. And you got three men inside that tank and it's just been kind of crunched in. How do you get out of a tank that's just been destroyed like that?
Well, we train to do crew maneuvers, or not crew maneuvers, but crew evacuations. And you're supposed to do it a certain way, but we couldn't go out through the loader's hatch because of the damage done to that side of the tank. So we had to go out through the commander's hatch. And I'm frankly too large to be in a tank. There's supposed to be a height cutoff of 6 feet. But since I joined when I was 17, I was 6 feet then. But then my senior year, I grew another 3 inches. So I was far too tall to be in a damn tank.
You outgrew the tank.
Yeah. So when it came to getting out, we were sitting there for a while, like a little bit, because once the ID went off, they started shooting again. So there's more RPGs and sniper fire. I'm trying to get out and like poke my head out and see what's going on. And nope, incoming rounds, you know, like all around the tank. It's like, shit, looks like we're staying in here. Hughes is still screaming. He was just out of his mind. I couldn't see him and I couldn't get to him due to the blown apart tank. I couldn't traverse the turret. I couldn't do anything. And he's just screaming. And you're like, can you see anything? Are you all right? We're trying to talk him through first aid. But he's pretty much just, and I didn't know it then, just repeating back whatever we said. He's like, can you see? He's like, where are my eyes? And like, just yelling crazy shit. And, you know, I'm like, oh my God, like, are his eyes gone? Like, I can't get to him because I can't even get out of the tux. And, you know, I get shot or blown up again. And then there's nothing you can do. So we had to wait until they provided security for us to try and get out. And eventually it goes quiet. And Hugh stops saying anything at all. So now we're worried that he's dead. And, you know, like, we didn't even know what's going on. And so I look out of the commander's hatch again. I see the vehicle beside us. They'd finally provided security. And it's like, are you guys all right? And fuck no, I just got blown up. There was supposed to be that system. You take casualties in a blast and you lose radio communication. You're supposed to throw a red chem light out of the top of the tank. Or if you're fine, but you lose radio, then you just throw out a green one. But the tank, the original place where that was stowed for us to do that, was blown apart. We didn't even know where the damn chem lights were. So they didn't know. There's no communication whatsoever. So what happened was, is they pulled Hughes out of the driver's hole, and that's why he stopped talking or saying. That's why I was like, oh, I thought he was dead because he's not in the tank anymore. I couldn't even tell. So finally, when it comes to getting out, the commander's hatch is pretty small. I'm a larger guy. Like, I wear like an extra large. And I'm trying to squeeze out with my vest on, and I can barely squeeze out of there. And then I try and use my leg to get out, and that's when I had actually put, you know, my entire body weight on my foot. And that's when I could feel it in my teeth when I stood on it, you know, like a like broken glass, like in your teeth. That's what it felt like. Like, all the way through my head, I was just, oh, shit, you know, and oof. Yeah. So anyway, I can't really get all the way out because I can't use my leg. And my right knee ended up, I tore a bunch of cartilage in my knee during the blast. It blew my leg up and back, and then it ripped a big old tear in it. So my legs aren't that well. They're not working that well right now. So I push out my tank commander, who's a smaller guy. He's, yeah. And so he gets out.
Was he injured?
Yeah, he snapped a bone in his foot. But other than that, not too much. The tank commander sits on a platform off of the turret floor. And that's probably why he was, I mean, he got injured, but he was mostly fine. So that was, he didn't even actually leave country. He just stayed there and rehabbed in place. But I push him out, and then he helps pull me out, you know, and I'm a bigger guy. So, you know, there's this little Louisiana man, oh, come on, like summoning all the strength to help pull me out. And then we're trying to stay low on top of the tank so, you know, we don't get sniped. And we roll off onto the hull and then roll off onto the ground. And then I try and stand up again, and I can't hop. It hurts my knee too much. Like, it, everything just kind of, that's when like the real pain started to kick in. Cause all the adrenaline and endorphins had worn off, and, felt crazy alone there, you know, crawling across the combat zone on my hands and knees in the middle of a street into the Bradley in front of us. So they didn't know, I think, that we were screwed up too. or at least as bad as I was. And I had to crawl, you know, about 25 meters, I'd say, into the back of this Bradley in front of us. And then finally they raised up the back door. And it's like, okay, we're safe. We're fine. You know, we can't tow the tank or anything like that. As a matter of fact, the engine was still running because it severed all of the cables in between the driver and the engine. It's designed to run like that. They sometimes call it combat overdrive to get you out of a sticky situation. But it just by default went there, and then it was still running, and then it eventually caught on fire while they were dragging it back to base. But we didn't stick around for that. They got the QRF, Quick Reaction Force, out there, which is another tank platoon waiting, and they hooked up the tank and dragged it back. As a matter of fact, it was funny though, because it was one of my buddies from a different squadron that actually did it. So it was kind of funny. So we, in the back of the Bradley, and we ride back, because we're so close to the FOB, forward operating base, that scrambling a helicopter and then trying to clear an area, it's just not worth it. So we just waited for QRF to get there as quick as possible, and then we just went back. And yeah, they dragged us out, and then we hopped in a vehicle and drove us over immediately. That's when they took the X-ray, and that's when I got my first shot of morphine. So,
And that was a big relief, I can imagine.
Yeah, it's like, oh man, finally. I was like, oh, this isn't going to be that bad, I guess, because you know, it's finally had some painkillers. During that time, medics weren't allowed to administer it. I think it was just our unit policy. I'm not 100% sure what's going on these days, but they gave you a combat pill pack, which is essentially some Motrin. But yeah, and it was weird. So I was sitting there, you know, and I'm also staring directly at two burned up corpses in like open body bags that are just like blown apart. And I don't know whether it was our guys or Iraqis, but you know, just staring at them while you're just sitting there trying to get through it. And
what kind of medical facilities were there?
It's probably like the equivalent to what would you call it?
Like a walk-in clinic?
Yeah. Thank you. That's definitely something like that. I mean, they definitely have a little bit more than one would have, because they can do emergency surgery and things like that. But it's pretty small, and it's kind of set up like that. Usually for anything that's, you know, worse than that, they're just going to fly you to Balad, which is the main medical hub for Iraq. I'm not sure where they fly everybody from Afghanistan, if they fly them to Balad as well. Or maybe at Camp Arifjan or something. Anyway.
Could you have done anything to avoid this? I mean, how much explosive material does it take to destroy a large tank like that?
Definitely a lot. That one, they estimated it up to 40 pounds of C4 or 400 pounds of homemade explosives, like acetylene tanks, propane tanks, you know. Fertilizer or whatever, you know, you can make bombs out of a lot of stuff, but it takes a lot.
So this wasn't an impulsive thing somebody just set up in the road. They'd been working on this for a while.
And most likely they had been waiting for a long time as well. Because we didn't roll down that street very often, at least not in that capacity. And
so it's not something you could have spotted and avoided.
We use a variety of tactics to see where, you know, IEDs are, whether it just be looking or using scopes. One of the interesting things, well, they also have a sonar, like ground penetrating sonar. And then I don't think we had that at that time, but that they have that now. And then we also use thermals to see where dirt has been disturbed recently. because it'll be a different color.
All right. Okay.
So there's nothing we could have done. We tried everything. They did it right, I guess.
Yep. You were in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's all it was. So your immediate treatment, they brought you back. Did you have to fly to the hospital or did they completely treat you there or what happened there?
They stabilized me at the hospital there, or the medical cache is what we call it. I think this is a fun part, but, I was in the ICU eventually, but, they had taken my foot and then put it up and then put it in a giant, cast to prevent drop foot, which is something that happens. You lose control and then it's a real sticky thing and a thing that sucks for a lot of people. There wasn't anything really holding, what's the best way to put this? Well, my heel was in over 10 pieces alone. And then the rest of my foot, you know, was broken in two. And so, you know, your Achilles tendon goes down and wraps around your heel. Well, when they pull it back, your foot back, it stretches and it goes on all that. And then what's barely holding on and very little there becomes suddenly very painful. It felt like there's napalm underneath my skin. So, and then that wasn't enough painkiller after that point. So then they put me on Dilaudid, which is basically super strong morphine. That's hydromorphone, technically, is the prescription name. But, and then that wasn't enough. And so they put me on fentanyl. And that's the thing that's killing everybody. I'm not sure if other people are near the opioid and heroin crisis, but that's what's killing everybody. So they ended up finally listening to me. I thought I was going to rip the head off the damn nurse. And they took it off and then they had to put me in the ICU because I was on such a huge quantity of medication that I could have died, you know. And then once they finally took it off and then let my foot rest, like they kind of made a blanket nest roll for it thing. And they put it down and took the brace off. And I finally was like, oh, okay. Woo. And I finally could sleep. So.
And when that happened, how long had you been there? How long after the explosion was that when you could finally rest?
I kind of lost concept.
Was it the same day or?
Oh, it was the same day.
Okay.
They couldn't operate because they didn't have hardware or anything like that there. So they're going to fly me to Balad, and I left the next day. And once I got to Balad, they tried to operate again, but then I had compartment syndrome, which is where the swelling kills off tissue. So I had compartment syndrome all over my foot and whatnot. So they cut it open and cut out all the dead flesh and put me on a wound vac, and they couldn't fix anything yet because they didn't have the hardware in my size, essentially. I have very large feet, 15s. So,
okay.
Yeah.
They don't stock steel rods that large, huh?
Yeah. So then they flew me back to Landstuhl where I had another two operations. And they still couldn't operate then. And so they then flew me to BAMC in San Antonio. And that's where I finally got, well, more surgeries, and then finally got my foot fixated. So
you said San Antonio. So you're back in the U.S. at this point.
Mm-hmm. It took about 4 days, maybe five, I think.
Were there any other injuries other than your foot?
Oh, well, I mean, my spine ended up with bulging discs and then it's compressed, and my knee, I had that tear in it. I'm not 100% sure what the result of this was, but one of my testicles had ended up turning into a giant tumor, possibly. I'm not saying it's related to the blast, but it happened during that time. I was wondering if it ruptured and then grew that way or what, but I had to have one of my boys taken out. So, and then what else? Yeah, I think that's.
So what was your, at this point, what was your prognosis? Were they going to just somehow fix your foot or?
Well, yeah, they were going to attempt and reconstruct it and get it to a point where, you know, it's usable. And that was the goal. Wasn't going to be pain-free, but usable. So fast forward, you know, a year and a half later, total of 13 surgeries on it. And it's nothing. It's the worst thing ever. My toenails are getting torn off when I walk. It's extreme pain. My left leg's shorter than my right. And it, my heel had broken off. Like the hardware broke and then my heel broke off and then it fused even with the rest of my foot. You know, it's supposed to form kind of a third point, you know, a little up higher. And it was, had fused flat, and I'm walking on the bottom of my ankle essentially now. And my toes were fused. I had osteomyelitis. My ankle was fused. And it was a huge piece of crap. And so I talked to my doctor about having it amputated. As well, I've been recovering for this year and a half, surgery after surgery. I'm seeing these guys come in that are amputees and leaving like 3 months later, or not 3 months, but like 6 months or a year later, completely fine and running, you know? And I was just like, well, what's going on with this? This is a piece of crap. Can we do that? And so they listened, and I had it electively amputated. So
did any of them advise you against amputation? Like they thought maybe they could get it worked out?
Well, I wouldn't say advise against it, but a lot of them, you know, believe that you should try and keep your body as it is. It's kind of a, I don't know what
the standard protocol or something.
Yeah. I mean, the doctor's like, oh, you know, he's trying all of his hardest work, and, or she is.
So they were trying to get you to not really say, okay, yeah, you should amputate, because in general, they want you to keep the parts that you have. But it sounds like it was kind of a no-brainer that it was time for the foot to go.
Yeah, for sure. The next time I saw, because my doctor at that time wouldn't do it, so I had to go see the head of orthopedics, and he agreed and said that he would do it. And then I walked in to have my leg amputated, which was weird. But fast forward 2 months later, the next time I saw him after this, after, you know, the post-op care in the hospital, was when I was hanging upside down off a pair of monkey bars, or not monkey bars, but a pull-up bar in the rehab facility. And they're like, oh, hey, I guess we made the right choice. I'm like, yeah, you know.
Where was the amputation? Where was the cut line?
About 6.5-7 inches below the knee.
Okay. I've heard there's a huge advantage to having it below the knee as opposed to above the knee.
Oh, for sure. Below the knee is kind of a rock star amputation almost, but it still, you know, sucks at times. But overall, it's just in total number of joints, it's better.
You still get the use of your knee anyway.
Yeah. I mean, they have some really cool legs now for above the knee, but they're still a lot easier to be below the knee.
And how long after the amputation do you have to wait before you can be fitted with a prosthetic?
Usually could start about 2 months, possibly. Was it three, two? I'm trying to remember. I think it was just two, which is another thing which blew my mind. But it makes sense because bone takes longer to heal. And if you're not worried about the bone healing in the same manner, I suppose, you can get up on your feet faster.
It seems like even after 2 months, it would still be with such a major traumatic action on your leg that it would still be sensitive or painful to put pressure on it there.
It was a little bit, but they're smart. They know that we were probably going to do something stupid. So for the military guys, they keep our legs at night for the first, you know, few weeks so we don't overdo it. So,
meaning your prosthetics aren't accessible to you because they don't want you going out running laps around or something.
Yeah, just doing something stupid or you know, going to the mall without, you know, crutches or something like that, and getting stranded because you can't wear your leg anymore. Or, yeah, it happened more than you think.
What was it like the first time you put that prosthetic on?
To be honest, I was just amazed. I was so excited. And I put it on, and then I stood up, and I was like, hey, man, this doesn't hurt as bad as my foot did already, you know, and it was the first time, and I was, all right. And it was pretty intuitive, you know, since I have my knee. You know, you just kind of get through it, but to build smoothness in your gait, that's different. And that's what all of the physical therapy we did was for, which is every day, twice a day for, you know, months. But I was just so amazed. I was up and walking that, I don't know, any, like, I didn't have, there was no sadness, there was no anything. I was just that excited to finally get up and do it.
Just to be able to walk and not have that pain anymore.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you adapted to it pretty quickly.
2 months after that, I was snowboarding. I was running.
That's pretty quick.
Why didn't I do this sooner? So it was about 4 or 5 months before I, you know, total, like from amputation to when I was doing that.
So did you get to the point where at that point, were you, when you're walking, you're not even thinking, okay, I got to be careful or I got to step this way, or it was just instinctive at that point?
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty fast then.
Yeah. There's like some finesse involved, but overall for most things, I didn't think about it at all. It was just pretty natural, but the manner in which I walk with my prosthetic was pretty similar to how I was having to walk with my foot anyway, because it was in a brace. My ankle was fused, toes were fused. So it was kind of there already.
Are you the same height as before the explosion?
Yep. Well, mostly. I mean, my spine got shorter. We'll put it that way. And then due to the explosion. And then I have a slight curvature in my back. It's what all unilateral amputees have. It's pretty much just because you favor one side or you lean. I mostly lean on my real leg if I'm standing still or something like that. So it just kind of does that over time.
Do you wear the prosthetic at night?
No.
Okay. You don't really need it, obviously, if you're just laying in bed. Yeah.
Well, usually if I'm even sitting on the couch, I take my leg off. It's just it's uncomfortable to have your knee bent backwards and have this giant mess of urethane and the sleeve and the liner to sit up underneath there. So
what does it feel like when you're sitting there just sitting on a couch watching TV? What does it feel like to be missing part of your leg? I've heard of phantom pain and things like that. Do you have that?
I used to. I still occasionally have it now. Mostly it's sensation. You know, I could still wiggle my toes in my head and like feel them. Like I can move them in my mind. And if I close my eyes, it's like they're not gone in a way, because you can still move them individually. And it's weird. You know, like I could still move my foot up and down, and you can see it all move on my stump. Because I'm not sure how the brain functions. I think we're still trying to figure that out when it comes to why that feeling's still there, you know.
And people that have not experienced it really don't understand what that's like, I'm sure.
I still feel weird explaining it, because I'm not sure if I'm doing it justice or saying it the right way. So
how was it dealing with the VA for your medical procedures?
After I've gotten out, or?
Well, going through that whole time, you said you had 13 surgeries.
I didn't deal with the VA during that time. This is active duty hospital, military treatment facility. And that was phenomenal. It's, you know, companies leap to try and get into military hospitals because you're seeing a lot of serious injuries, and you know, you get the government funding for it. So it was phenomenal.
And then do you have ongoing treatment now? Or are you dealing with the Veterans Administration for medical treatment now?
Yes, I am now. I go in up to Cleveland for prosthetic care and most things, you know, for my shrink, I go to Akron. But
all right. Well, let's talk a little bit about that then. You mentioned a shrink.
Mm-hmm.
Are you dealing with PTSD, depression, anything like that?
Yeah. Definitely PTSD. I mean, I'm talking about it today, and it's taken, it's been 10 years, you know, and I'm still have issues with it from time, well, not from time to time, but often. A lot of PTSD ends up, or at least for me, it changes who you are, then it tweaks your personality. You don't even realize what's going on anymore, and it's been weird. And then with depression, I was, you know, a depressed wreck for years. I ended up hospitalizing myself last year in October for 9 days. And then I finally got the start of the help that I needed. And now I'm on a stiff dose of antidepressants. So,
And that's effective? That's helpful?
Yes. Yeah.
Good. That's good to hear. What's your position on medical marijuana?
It's a plant that grows in the woods. Like, you know, I don't smoke, but it seems common sense to me.
Have you ever been prescribed that or?
No, we just had it legalized up here, this past last year, but I still think they're hammering out some of the, issues with it or how it's going to be handled. I know that they just tried to get the VA to do that. And they're urging them to study that as well. I mean, they're also using MDMA for severe cases of PTSD. And there's a lot of things out there.
Yeah. But, a lot of factors to consider and getting that passed. Yeah.
We've got a lot of brothers and sisters that use it for their mental health needs and stuff like that. And they love it and they're happy, and it's, you know, it's not, Mother Nature did it right, so why should we screw it up kind of thing. So,
all right, well, let's talk about your life after this event. I know you're still dealing with it, but are you on disability now? Do you have ongoing medical treatment the rest of your life, or what's that look like?
Yeah, I'll be undergoing medical stuff for the rest of my life.
Well, what can you describe, what's your life like now?
Oh, now it's, medically retired. I don't have to work, but I have worked. I jumped between a whole bunch of jobs and stuff like that. And I was a depressed wreck, just fell into the bottle for a long time. And you know, I lost that purpose and stuff like that. I still, you know, go to the VA, still dealing with a couple of issues with the VA, in regards to benefits, like a traumatic brain injury and things like that. But I was going to school for a while, and then I had to back out because it was during that time I hospitalized myself. So from then, it's these days, I mean, it's actually really good since then. You know, I have an amazing fiance. I got our first kid on the way. Things are actually really starting to look up with the medication and everything else.
Are you able to drive?
Yep.
Okay.
I mean, it's my left foot, so I mean, I was always right-footed, so that makes sense. So, you know, an automatic is fine. It's illegal for an amputee to drive manuals, but I may or may not have driven one for a while.
Well, a lot of people with two regular feet can't drive a stick shift, so you're doing pretty well.
Yeah.
Do you have is there a plans for another career or anything like that?
Well, I want to finish my degree in applied mathematics and hopefully get into something regarding the space race that we have going on, working for one of these companies, you know, or at least just something. I really love math. So, you know, the world is very gray and black and white. Math, you know?
Math is a science. It's
yeah.
How did the explosion change your outlook on life? If it did in any way?
I mean, it's my outlook is still something I struggle with from time to time, finding purpose in what I want to do and the meaning of life and whatnot. But it's kind of after everything kind of turned me into more of a humanitarian, almost a, I wouldn't say humanitarian, but understanding of the human condition more so, and a bit of a pacifist these days. Not saying that I would never fight, you know, if we were invaded or something like that, but I don't know. I just don't see the point in war, I guess, unless you absolutely have to. And it seems that to me, we tend to go stick in our business in places where it shouldn't be.
I think a lot of people feel that way, you know, and I hadn't thought about it when we first connected. It was like a week ago, or actually more than that. And we determined that, okay, yeah, let's have our conversation, you know, this like next Tuesday. I hadn't realized the date significance of today being where, as we record this, it's September 11. Mm-hmm. Obviously a big day in our country and with the military and everything. So let me say this, maybe I should have started the show with this. Thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you.
Do you get that when people find out that you were in the military? A lot of people thank you, and you ever get tired of that?
I'm not much of a, I mean, I get people thanking me often, which is great. I think it's good to support the military, even if you don't support the war. So that's, I think people have gotten a lot better about that. Grandpa was a Vietnam vet, and he came home right before the Kent State shooting and, you know, was around for that. But to me, I'm not good at receiving compliments, let alone gratitude. So, I mean, I always appreciate and try and do my best to thank whomever as well, but I don't know. It's a weird thing for me. It's like, I loved the military. I loved what I did. You know, in the military, it gave me purpose, and it gave me, you know, a lot of opportunities. And, you know, I don't know. I'm grateful for the military. So
do you get comments on your new leg when you're out?
Oh, this one. Yes. My other leg, not so much. It looks like the one I had before. This kind of looks like a standard leg, but this new one, it's made by Oser. It's called the Cheetah Explorer, I think. And it's pretty strange looking. It, you know,
how's it, in what way?
It looks like one of those, you know, Oscar Pistorius running legs, but it actually has an entire foot on it. So I can wear it, you know, with normal shoes and things like that. So it looks, you know, a little bit alien or foreign. And I think it kind of looks cool. I mean, I always thought carbon fiber looked cool anyway. So,
and you can run and everything. Is there anything you can't do?
Can't moonwalk, and I can't do calf raises.
What was the second thing?
Calf raises.
Calf raises. Oh, yeah. For weightlifting, you're talking about.
Yeah, that's. Okay. Well, I mean, I can with one leg, but.
Okay. All right. Well, as we wrap it up here, do you have? You know, there's going to be people listening to this that are also veterans and possibly also amputees. Do you have any advice for them? What would you say to someone like that?
Just don't stop. I mean, if you stop, and I know that's hard because when you get down, and I know I've done it, you just crumble into your own self and your own depression, and you stop living your life, and you got to get started again. You got to stick with it. And it's okay to need help, you know, if you need medication or therapy. I mean, it's good for, I think, everybody just to see a therapist every now and then anyway, whether you're healthy or not. But, you know, just, you can't stop. And if you have stopped, you got to get going. And I know it's hard. I know it's hard. It's taken me years, almost 10. So I guess that's it. I mean, don't be too proud to ask for help and keep going.
Josh, what was it? What was the reaction of your parents or your mom when you first told them that this had happened?
Well, my mom found out when I was high on Dilaudid right after I got blown up, not more than probably 2 hours after it, I would say. And my sergeant major handed me a phone. And I remember it's this dinky ass little phone, you know, no longer than like three and a half inches. And so he's like, okay, you want to call your mom? I was like, sure. And so
that seems really fast, you know?
Yeah. I was like, really? I mean, I'm okay. I mean, sure. But I didn't know I was going to be the one telling her, you know, like what happened, all that noise. So the reason I said that comment about the small phone, because it pissed me off because I couldn't talk into it and hear at the same time.
Oh, so you had to keep moving it back and forth. Okay.
Yeah, on my face because I couldn't talk well and then like I'm slurring. And so my mom answers the phone and I'm like, oh, mom, I got blown up, you know? And she's like, wait, what? What? Are you drunk? And I was like, no, mom, I'm not drunk. I'm in fucking Iraq. I got blown up. And she's like, what? And then she finally understood it and, you know, sat down and I was like, okay, I don't really remember what I said other than that, but, you know, hung up and then got back to it. She's the only person I called. And lo and behold, though, because I had called her, the Army decided that it wasn't important to keep up the communication and to let her know more because I had already made a phone call. So she's just in the dark for the next 5 days, pretty much. She ends up freaking out and calling people for hours. She gets in touch with a lady from Soldiers Angels in Germany. And so this is about 2-3 days later. And it's like, my mom was like, I told her, it's like, does he like anything? I'm like, he likes fleece blankets and gummy bears. It's like, and so I was getting dragged off the transportation bus on a stretcher into the hospital in Germany. And some lady was like, are you Josh Holm? I was like, yeah, who the hell are you? And I just get a fleece blanket and a giant bag of gummy bears thrown on me. And I was like, all right.
Wow.
And then another little bit right after that, David Baldacci, you know, the author.
I've heard
rather famous. Yeah.
What has he written?
No clue. I don't really.
I've heard the name, really, but I'm not, I don't know if I've read any of his books.
I think similar to John Grisham or something, but, yeah, he came into my hospital room in Germany. I was in Landstuhl. I was, who the hell are you? And he gave me 2 signed books and some chocolates. And I was like, this is the weirdest thing ever. Like,
that is pretty random. Yeah.
It's like, okay.
Well, Josh, you've been through a lot. It sounds like you're at least over the worst of it, and which I'm glad to hear about. And if anyone wants to contact you, I have your email address. I'll put that in the show notes for this episode, along with links to other things that we've talked about here in this conversation. And thanks again for sharing your story.
Awesome. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode. My goal for each show is to introduce you to people and stories that you just won't find on other podcasts. If you want to help support the show, you just need to subscribe, and that way you'll never miss an episode. You can click on any of the subscribe buttons on the website, which is whatwasthatlike.com. You'll see all the links right there at the top where you can subscribe directly to this show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, or on whatever app you use to catch your podcasts. And you'll see there are also links to Twitter and Instagram, so you can follow us there, and I hope you do. And if you really want to connect with me and get in on the discussion with other listeners to this show, you can join our private Facebook group. You can find that at whatwasthatlike.com/Facebook. And of course, you can always email me directly at scott@whatwasthatlike.com. Or just go to the website and click on contact.
I'd love to hear what you think of this episode or a previous episode. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you on the next show where we'll once again ask the question, what was that like?